anchors away as we embark on a new edition of Science and Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease. Real research is getting underway on the British Antarctic Survey's new research ship, the Sir David Attenborough. We'll be getting the mood from one of the team in a moment. We're also looking at the colonial legacy in climate change.
Looking at the UK specifically, its responsibility for current climate change nearly doubled. That was taking into account emissions under British rule in 46 former colonies.
And talking pollution more generally, coal smoke turns out to be more deadly than previously thought. Time for a further rethink on coal power. And the team trying to solve the mystery of rare childhood genetic diseases in Africa.
And they are really eager to find out exactly what is the problem in the family so that they have closure as to why both their babies have died and what are the chances of this happening again.
But let's start in the Southern Ocean, off the coast of the West Antarctic Peninsula, the bit that stretches and curls towards South America. That's where the British Antarctic Survey's shiny new research vessel, the Sir David Attenborough, is just starting its first scientific voyage after years of construction and preparation. It's the beginning of a five-year exploration called Biopol, looking at the importance of the polar oceans to the rest of the globe. The team are excited to have started, but we did manage to persuade marine ecologist Nadine Johnston to spare us a few minutes.
I can't begin to put into words how excited I am. Actually, I've just got goosebumps as you asked me that question, because not only has there been work going on for several years to get this ship built and get her operational and put her through all of the trials that you can imagine, there's been several years of planning from the whole entire team that is involved in the Biopol project, which is the focus of this cruise. So actually to finally get down here and bring this project to life with its Southern Ocean component is just absolutely fantastic. It's an historic moment. This is the ship's, you know, maiden science cruise, so it's really wonderful, and I feel very privileged to be part of that as well.
Being the beginning of the science, this means what? You're putting equipment into the ocean, you're sending people onto the land. Give me a sense of the physicality of it all.
This project that I'm talking about is Biopol. So it's called Polar Ecosystems and Global Impacts. And this is a £9 million multidisciplinary project funded by NERC, the Natural Environment Research Council. And it involves a number of different research centres, and it's led out of the British Antarctic Survey. And the focus of it is really, it's addressing a major unknown in the way our Earth system functions, how those polar ecosystems, both the Arctic and the Antarctic, regulate the balance of carbon and nutrients in our world's oceans to keep them healthy and to keep them productive. So the focus of this cruise is to look at processes in the springtime. During the winter, you have this enormous growth of sea ice over the ocean, which almost doubles the size of Antarctica. And in the springtime, that sea ice begins to melt. And that's a big power bank of nutrients. And as it melts, it releases those nutrients into the water column and kickstarts an enormous, what we call a bloom, huge growth of these tiny microscopic plants, which then kickstarts the zooplankton bloom, which then feed all of the other predators, all the way from fish and squid up to whales, that many of them come down to the Southern Ocean to complete their breeding cycle. So it's a really exciting time of year. So we're going in to, you know, learn more about this chain of events.
I mean, I know you're in the warmth of your cabin at the moment, but if you're up on deck, is the ocean icy around you or is it already open?
Yeah, I can see a chain of icebergs all the way around us at the moment. It's not too cold at the moment, just sub-zero at about 0.5 degrees. And there's lots of sea ice around us, and that's breaking up as well as we head northwards to the tip of the Antarctic Peninsula at the moment.
And so you're going to be sort of scouting around large parts of the Antarctic to do this study?
Yes, we are. At first, we left the Falklands Islands a few days ago, and we headed down south, down the west side of the Antarctic Peninsula to resupply Rothera Research Station, delivering them long-awaited fresh fruit and vegetables that they've been missing out on during the winter. So now
you must have been welcome.
We were very welcome. And then we took some time to trial our equipment just near Rothera Base in Ryder Bay. So that gave us a chance to put out what we call our CTDs. CTD stands for conductivity, temperature and depth. So it's an instrument that has an array of water bottles on it and sensors that you can drop from the surface of the ocean right down to depths of, you know, 4,000 meters. And you can profile the water column on the way down. So you can find out information on the temperature, the saltiness of the water, but you can also capture water samples and look at the nutrients or the phytoplankton that are living in the water column at any particular depth. So it's a really neat tool. So now we've done that and we know everything is working quite nicely. We're heading back up to the tip of the Antarctic Peninsula, and then we'll do a right-hand turn, hopefully going past the large iceberg A23A, and then we're heading down into the Weddell Sea, which is a really cool area, and trying to hit the sea ice. So we're going. The plan is to do a long transect from the open ocean all the way down as far as we can crush into that sea ice, so we can get a nice profile of what's going on from an open water environment into the sea ice as well.
Your cabin does sound very well sound insulated. I imagine that if you go outside, there are some amazing noises. And I know you've recorded some for us. So,
yeah.
You know, talk us through some of the amazing sounds of the work that you do.
Yeah, I'll agree that our cabins are incredibly silent. But as soon as you step out, if you step out onto the side deck or up onto the observation deck or up onto the heli deck, you just get this swirling wind and you can hear the engines roaring behind you, particularly if we're trying to keep station and deploy our CTDs and our nets over the side. You have this big roar of the thrusters. And then you've got also all of the bustling sounds within the ship as well. You can hear the hum of the engine inside the ship. If you go into the mess to have lunch or dinner, you've got the clanking of everybody's plates and the chatter of everyone talking about their day so far. And you have the chefs singing away if you catch them. And yeah, so there's an amazing combination of sounds both inside and out. And one of the things that I've enjoyed the most so far is hearing the ship actually crunching through the ice. When we pulled into Rothera Station the other morning, you could see over the side these big, large ice floes turning over, covered in algae on the underside of them. And they were just crunching and groaning by the side of the ship, which is just incredible.
Obviously, you're very interested in the science that you're doing. You're interested in the way that the oceans wake up around Antarctica. Mm-hmm. But this is not just interest, it's important. You wrote an essay recently, the Southern Ocean ecosystem affects the entire world. This is really of global interest.
Absolutely. And this will help policymakers make much more informed decisions about how to adapt to climate change in the future. And often we think that those polar environments, the Arctic and the Antarctic, they're ecosystems that are far away and really remote, but actually they're really globally important. So not only do they provide iconic animals such as penguins and polar bears, etc., they also supply us with fisheries, they supply us with tourism, they supply nutrients to the rest of the global ocean. But importantly, they also help us fight that climate change, regulate our climate by drawing down carbon from the atmosphere. So understanding what happens in these poles and their sensitivity to climate is really a key component of understanding how our Earth system functions.
Nadine Johnston of the British Antarctic Survey, ahead of what sounds like a busy few weeks of exploration. There are busy weeks ahead too in Dubai, where the annual climate COP negotiations have just started. COP for Conference of Parties, and that's to the UN Climate Convention. A stocktake were promised of progress since commitments were made in Paris 2015 to reducing carbon emissions in order to prevent dangerous climate change. Expect to hear a lot of blame game about who's the worst polluter. Finger pointing, for example, at China for its huge and growing impact on climate. Others will point to history, to the decades of pollution and deforestation in Europe and the US, long before other economies took off. And the publication Carbon Brief this week reports we should add colonial history into the mix. Imperial powers should be responsible, they say, for what happened in their colonial territories in the past. Carbon Brief's Simon Evans told me why history matters.
People might have heard of the carbon budget, and this is effectively the amount of CO2 that we can emit if we want to stay below any given temperature target. So for 1.5, there's a carbon budget. For 2 degrees, there's a carbon budget, and so on. And that's a finite amount, and that covers all emissions over history. The bit that people don't necessarily understand is that even though individual CO2 molecules go out into the atmosphere as they're emitted from, you know, power stations, cars, and so on, they're absorbed by plants, they get dissolved in the oceans, and they're absorbed by living things and then respired and they go back into the atmosphere. But despite all of that cycling, that concentration is effectively forever. So once we emit CO2 into the atmosphere, it just stays there.
So the imprint of a lump of coal burnt in Dickens's London, that imprint remains in the atmosphere, even if individual carbon molecules have sort of switched around.
Yeah, exactly right. It's more or less equal. One ton of CO2 in 1850 is more or less the same in its warming impact as one ton of CO2 today.
You know, I've always got this idea that countries which industrialised early, for example, they've had the economic advantage of burning that coal and burning that wood early on. But you're now extending this to colonialism, which I think is quite an interesting idea. So in other words, that Britain, for example, is not only responsible for what was burnt in Britain 100 years ago.
The reason that we got interested in this idea of colonial responsibility, effectively, we did an exercise 2 years ago. We published an article with analysis looking at which countries are most responsible for climate change. And we published that, and it has a top 10, and quite prominent in that top 10 were India and Indonesia. And amongst the many comments and reactions that that analysis created were certain people, often from those countries, saying, well, hang on a minute, how's that fair? Indonesia was ruled over by the Dutch for hundreds of years. India had a heavily colonial influence, was part of the British Empire for a long period of time. Surely they were responsible for what happened. And so we didn't have the ability to do that. We didn't have the data that we would need to start thinking about that. But we thought about it, and we felt that there was something to that. Now, obviously, it's quite tricky. And we basically found a database created by some academics. I think it was about 2010. And that effectively listed for each country and each year. It said, let's say, India, 1900, part of the British Empire. India, 1901, part of the British Empire, and so on, until finally 1947, India independent. And so we combined that data with the data on emissions in each country and each year. And we said, so for periods when a country was under colonial rule, we would reassign those emissions to the colonial ruler as the one that had the ultimate decision-making power at that point.
And again, the sort of the logic of partly one of power, but also the nature of colonialism is that the colonial power would be the ones, as it were, stripping assets to getting the profits from the colonies.
I'm actually a chemist by training, so I'm certainly not a historian, but I did read a bit into the history of this, and it's actually very eye-opening. Empire and the environment were very intimately linked. So you think about the British Isles themselves had largely been deforested by the point that, the empire started expanding. And if you think about things like railways that need timber for railway sleepers, and that was obviously a way to project British power in colonies. And so having largely deforested large parts of the British Isles, it was the case that the British were looking around the world to try and find sources for those materials that they needed, whether it's fur, oil, rubber, and so on, as the country industrialised. And so the environment was immediately tied up in this colonization process.
What's surprising, looking at your tables, is what a big difference this makes to particularly European powers in terms of their historic responsibility for carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Yeah, so what we found, once we completed this exercise, adding up all of those periods of colonial rule and transferring responsibility for those emissions. So just for example, looking at the UK specifically, its responsibility for current climate change nearly doubled. That was taking into account emissions under British rule in 46 former colonies. So most prominently on those was India, Australia, Nigeria. And then if you look at other former colonial powers, the French contribution to climate change on this basis goes up by 50%. For the Netherlands, it's a really big impact. It's obviously a small country itself, but was the colonial ruler of Indonesia for a long period of time. And so its contribution to climate change nearly triples under this colonial emissions basis.
I mean, for you, is the question of justice incredibly important here?
If people think about their own lives, very trivial, kind of almost silly examples, but, you know, if you're in a pub and you knock someone's drink over, you probably buy them a new one. There's, you know, if you miss your wife's anniversary, you're probably going to try and make it up. There's little ways in which we each acknowledge the idea of taking responsibility for past actions and bearing that in mind in how we act in the future. And ultimately, climate justice is just kind of that writ large. It's about saying, we've got this big problem, we need to sort it out, everyone needs to act, but actually, we're not equally responsible for this problem, and we're not equally capable of responding. And so, you know, if we're going to do all of this together, we actually probably need to acknowledge that.
Simon Evans of Carbon Brief, on a line from Dubai as the climate negotiations start there. We've often argued here on Science in Action that the harms of fossil fuels go beyond global warming, that millions of deaths worldwide each year can be ascribed to air pollution from burning coal and oil. And a new study marrying US health data with pollution patterns suggests coal is even worse than previously appreciated. Corey Ziegler was one of the number crunchers.
We estimate something around 460,000 deaths in the United States among people age 65 and older in the 20-ish year period between 1999 and 2020. This is close to twice as many deaths as we thought were coming from coal during this time period.
So let's unpick this a bit. First of all, you've had access to medical records, is it? And you've matched up those medical records with the numbers of power plants, something like that.
It's billing data, essentially, for Medicare, which is the government-provided insurance for people 65 and older in the United States. When they go to the hospital or when they die, we might know why they were in the hospital, and we know what postal code they live in.
Do the records also include whether it was for lung problems, or is that part of the sort of the clever data matching you have to do?
So since our study looked at all-cause mortality, the records do not have a cause of death. We do have, if somebody is hospitalized, for example, what their diagnosis was when they were hospitalized. But that was not something that was considered in our study.
So it's essentially the correlation between the number of people who are dying and the concentrations of air pollutants that you're looking at.
That's right. It's that association when estimated, adjusted for any number of other factors about the person or the neighborhood they live in.
And what is it about the coal fumes that are so dangerous? Just walk me through that.
So I can back up a little bit. In the U.S., there are monitors on the smokestack of every power plant that are measuring essentially exactly what's coming out of that power plant. In our case, we picked the chemical, the pollutant that's most associated with coal combustion, which is sulfur dioxide, SO2. So we know exactly what sulfur dioxide is coming out of every power plant going back 20 years. After it comes out of the power plant smokestack, it moves. So the wind blows it around. Other things happen too. And so the next thing that we did is we deployed this air quality model that essentially uses historical wind data to say, if pollution came out of this smokestack at this time, where did it go? The pollution can move hundreds of kilometers from a coal power plant. So I live in Texas. I go outside. I might be breathing air from a power plant that was in Oklahoma or someplace hundreds of kilometers away. One of the things that I think is really unique about our study is we have the ability to select an area, say a state, and identify which power plants across the country are the ones that are contributing most to the deaths in that state, which I think has potential to impact decision making.
You mean if state senators or anything were interested, you could say, to improve the health of your county, your state, look first at this power plant or that power plant, or even the one in the neighbouring state.
Exactly. That's the idea.
You know, this is just for the United States. Mm-hmm. I know that there are big international studies about global deaths from air pollution, and I was wondering if you can translate the lessons for this from the United States to, say, China, where they've got massive growth in their coal-fired burning, or in South Asia, India and so on, where mm-hmm. they have big problems.
The main take-home that I do think is relevant in any global context from this study is that we've learned that the pollution that originates from coal combustion for electricity generation is among the most harmful or the most toxic particulate pollution out there, more toxic than the pollution from all sources that's usually considered in epidemiological studies.
Okay, so I found that quite interesting because I'd imagined that whether it came from, let's say, vehicles or from wildfires or from coal, it was all the same thing. And that's your point, is that actually there's something about the particulates or the pollution that may be specific to some of these sources.
That's right. So when we say fine particulate pollution or particulate pollution, we're just talking about particles of a certain size. But those particles, even if they're all the same size, may have very different chemical makeups or other properties that are different. And so that leads us, and there's other science on this, suggesting that not all PM is created equally. The source that it comes from may matter for the toxicity when breathed by humans.
One other thought I've been thinking about this year is when you had very extensive wildfires in North America, particularly the ones in Canada, mm-hmm. that turned the skies red in New York and Chicago and places. Could you do the same kind of exercise to try and work out what the health effects of these wildfires are, which presumably could be a bigger concern in a warming world?
Yes, there are tools much like the ones we deployed for power plants, or even the tool we developed to evaluate power plants, that could be repurposed to investigate wildfires. I've not done any of these studies personally. I couldn't speak to the details. But there are plenty of people who are trying to do just as you described, research the epidemiological implications of wildfire-specific smoke to indicate, is this stuff even more harmful than we might think, or is it not as harmful as tailpipe emissions from a car, for example?
Corey Ziegler of the University of Texas in Austin. His analysis was published in Science. And finally, the power of genetics to solve the puzzle of some diseases. It's 20 years since the first human genome was almost fully read, a start to understanding what each of our 20,000 genes do. But it's the small defects in a gene, here or there, that can lead to devastating illness, often in childhood or even before birth. In America and Europe, huge progress has been achieved in recognising some of these defects. But elsewhere, it's catch-up. And on my recent visit to Cape Town, I got to see the new Rare Disease Genomics in South Africa initiative at Tygerberg Hospital, run by Professor of Genetics Shahida Musa.
We are really excited because this work is not being done in Africa. So African patients have not had access to the testing that they need as children, adults, individuals in the UK or the US have had access to for the last two decades. We're slowly trying to catch up.
It seems like in lots of populations, there's just one or two people will have something which is unexplained, and by reading their genome, you can actually find what the fault is. And so this is cutting-edge research around the world.
Right, and especially so in Africa, because we don't even have the foundations that we need of what is quote-unquote normal variation or expected variation in our population, because we have not sequenced enough African individuals for us to say this is our baseline and anything that deviates from this might cause disease.
And the other thing for me is that I don't think it's appreciated enough, the genomes over Africa are so much more diverse than genomes in the rest of the world.
Africa has the highest diversity of all other continents. Humankind started here and then moved and took some of the diversity that was available on the continent with them to the farthest corners of the earth. And the problem is that people talk about Africa as being one thing, a monolith. It is not.
Jessica, what do you got in your hands there? What have you got in your hands there?
A little distraction in the background.
Yeah.
I'm just inverting our blood samples.
So these are blood samples which were collected
straight from the clinic.
So this is a child.
Two children
who've got some problem, mm-hmm. and you've got to find the DNA in there. Mm-hmm. And that knowledge that there's some child who needs your help.
Yeah.
What kind of motivation is that?
No, I take it very seriously. It's one of the reasons I went into medical research. It's the reason I am here now. It's not just data. These are babies. This is someone's family. You take it very seriously because it could be you. It could be your sister. It's a person, not just a sample.
We're holding you up. What do you need to do?
I'm just going to start extracting now then. Normally, the amount of blood we get varies depending on the clinic day, depending on how busy it was or how many new patients we have. But today, you can see I only have two from this week. I think last week I extracted 11, so it really varies. So yeah. Today will be quite a quick one.
Okay.
So these are our little pipettes.
Okay, so the twisting noises as you adjust the setting.
Then we get our sterile tips. This is our protease.
That's an enzyme.
It's a bit corrosive, so that's why we need to use gloves.
That's going to break down some of the blood, is it?
Yes. So you don't want to spill that on your hand.
Because it starts digesting you.
That's a good way of putting it.
Some of our patients are stillborn fetuses.
Yeah.
And it's often not easy to get blood from them. So we have to get creative. I can take a little snip from the umbilical cord, for example. Mm-hmm. And I brought that back and surprised Jessica with that the other day and said, I need DNA, please. And at the end, we got really good DNA, and we hope to be able to give the family some answers.
And the question there is why the child didn't survive the pregnancy.
Correct, yes. And it was the second baby that this family had lost. And we didn't have a chance to do testing on the first one. And they are really eager to find out exactly what is the problem in the family so that they have closure as to why both their babies have died and what are the chances of this happening again. Is there something we can do to intervene? A diagnosis makes such a difference. You actually have a name, you have information that you can work with.
Jessica, you've got the first sample squeeze out there.
All right, good. Off to the vortex.
The vortex?
Yes. So this is the vortex, and I'm going to vortex for 15 seconds. And turn them on. There we go.
And this just sort of spins the DNA and all the other stuff out.
Let's make sure they're all
this is to mix
working
it.
Together, yes. There we go. I'll move.
Shaken, not stirred.
Oh, correct. Well, stirred and shaken in this context.
That's better than any kitchen blender I've ever used. So presumably you're beginning to build up quite a cohort of people that you're studying.
We have enrolled 900 and something, so almost 1,000 patients. Of those, we've sequenced about half of them, so 400 and something have been sequenced, almost 500. And then half of those have gotten a diagnosis immediately.
And are those diagnoses because you can match their genes to something that someone else has matched?
Right, there's two aspects to that answer. An immediate diagnosis means that it's a variant in a gene that we've seen before. Then there are variants that we identify and I say, oh, I think this is causing the disease, but we don't have a second patient or we've never seen anything like this before. Then I reach out to the networks internationally to say, do you have patients who have variants in gene X? What do they look like? Do they also have extra fingers and extra toes? Because that's what my patient looks like. They would say, yes, we collaborate, and a new gene is then published. So there's a lot of novel gene discovery happening at the moment because African patients have not been sequenced.
And you're talking about one letter mutation in a whole gene, and the gene can be how many letters long?
Several thousands of
several
letters.
Several thousands.
Yes.
And I think people need to know that not every gene is a direct replica necessarily of the other. You and I will probably have the same gene but with little variants, but there are mutations on top of that.
Correct.
Which is what you're looking for.
So different people, all of us that are standing here, we're all human. We all have what we call natural variation. So there's variants that are not necessarily really causing disease in each of us. The trick is to notice when something is different to what we call the reference. Is that something that is just variation for variation's sake, or is that something that is actually responsible for the disease? And that is more difficult for me than for some of my colleagues overseas, because they have really robust databases that they can refer to. And if the database is composed of healthy individuals and they see that variant in the database, they can say, oh no, you know, it's likely not causing the disease in the patient. If they don't see it in the database, they can be quite sure that maybe this is causing the disease in their patients.
Yeah.
If I use those same databases,
they're no good
less
for you.
Helpful for me, because they're composed of European ancestry patients. What we really need is an African genome database.
There's so much catching up to be done.
We would likely need several hundred thousand, a couple of million people to be sequenced, just because there's so many different populations within Africa that in order to build a robust database, we'd need many, 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 many people to be sequenced.
I mean, chasing down those kinds of details, I'm presumably that's why you're a professor in this business, because it must fascinate you.
Absolutely. I don't think there's anything else that's more fascinating. We want to understand what makes us humans. We want to understand every single gene and what every single letter in that gene is doing, and whatever variants, what their end effect is. Because at the end of the day, we're going back to a person, and we need to understand the biology of it and the pathophysiology of it in order for us to strive to get a therapy for them. So a one-size-fits-all is not going to be the way that things are going to be working for rare diseases, for example, because like I said, in one gene, you might have two different variants that do two totally different things. So we not only need a gene-driven approach, we might need a variant-driven approach. That makes things exciting and also a little scary.
Shaida Moussa of Stellenbosch University's Tigerberg campus in Cape Town. And you also heard graduate researcher Jessica Jane Cormack. Really important and impactful research. And that draws Science in Action from the BBC to a close this week. I'm Roland Pease. The producer is Alice Lipscomb-Southwell. Thanks for listening.